Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stock.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
I recorded three episodes, and I noticed one of them I did last night right after I watched the president's speech, and I had a laptop with a little camera. And the quality there wasn't as good as the quality of the unit I had in my office for the first two. Although the second one, when I did it, I didn't realize when I recorded it, there was a lot of light coming into my office, and so it ended up being a big shadow on me. So I got to try to pay a little bit more attention to some of the quality, and I got to get a little bit better equipment. But I'm starting to do it now. And initially it was called a weekly blog, but it's not really weekly. I'm going to be sending out things whenever I feel like it. As like yesterday, I ended up with two. I did one in the morning, and then after Obama spoke, I did another one. So some days there could be a couple. I'm probably not going to do one at all today. You know, I'm traveling out in California. And if I did one, I'd have to do one on that same little camera that I used last night, which wasn't that great. But anyway, they're up there. If you want to subscribe to the video blog, if you haven't done it, if you subscribe to it, then I think you get alerted each time a video blog goes out. Also, I think we sent out a newsletter today. I know it's been a while since the last issue came out. Sometimes we get backed up with things, and so the newsletters don't go out as often as I'd like, but I think there was one that just came out. Also, I think we just might have sent out a link to a new special report, which was mistitled by some of the marketing people, Peter Schiff's Five Favorite Stocks for 2009. That was a mistake. Basically, it's five favorite stocks for the next 5 years. Somebody accidentally wrote in for 2009, and I had corrected that several times, but for some reason, the version that I wrote didn't get out. I allowed somebody else to proof it and finalize it, and obviously, they screwed up. So if you happen to see that report, it's actually five stocks for the next 5 years, not five stocks for 2009. Anyway, I guess the first thing we should talk about is the president's speech last night, although I certainly said a lot about it on that video blog that I recorded, so I don't want to be too repetitious. If you really want to hear my thoughts on it, take a look at that video blog or sign up for that. But basically, Barack Obama is coming into office, and he's got apparently an 80% approval rating now, which I guess I don't know how that compares to presidents in general when they first come to office. I think they start out pretty high, and people generally give these people the benefit of the doubt for some reason when they first come into office. Basically, he's trying to come in here and let us know that things are bad, but that he's going to turn it around, that he inherited a bad situation from Bush. And the reason the situation is bad is because Bush cut taxes, and Bush put too much faith in free market capitalism, and there wasn't enough regulation. And because of 8 years of Republican tax cuts and letting Wall Street run amok, that the country's a mess, and that he's going to fix it with New Deal style, Roosevelt type programs. And he's saying that things are going to get worse for a while, which is quite an understatement, but that if we just bear with him, that eventually his plan is going to work, that raising taxes on the rich, regulating Wall Street more, but working in cooperation with Wall Street, and spending a lot of money and printing a lot of money is going to somehow restore our economy to economic vitality. This is all a bunch of nonsense. I mean, there is no prayer that what he is going to do is going to help the economy. It isn't even a question of, apparently I think what the vice president said, that he thought that there was a 30% chance that this stuff was going to work. Well, first of all, I don't know where he got the odds. I mean, who did he get to figure out that there was a 30% chance it would work? But that means there's obviously, even according to the administration, a 70% chance that it's not going to work. Well, then why are we doing it? I mean, if there's a 70% chance it's not going to work, then the odds seem to say that we shouldn't do it. But there's no chance, in my mind. I don't think the odds are 30% that it will work. I think the odds are zero that it will work, because it can't work. It's flawed from the very design. It's impossible for it to work. Now, can it result in a little bit more consumer spending than would otherwise have been the case? Yes. Could it result in us going deeper into debt? Yeah. But none of that's going to help. You know, Barack Obama thinks that the way to solve the crisis is to find ways to get credit flowing to consumers. That's so consumers can go buy stuff. Well, you know, the way we want consumers to buy stuff is to make stuff. We don't want people buying on credit. We also want people buying out of savings, buying out of incomes. I mean, we don't want to try to recreate an economy where people go out and borrow money and then spend it. I mean, we're suffering from that because people borrowed money and now they can't pay it back. And obviously, the solution isn't to find ways to borrow even more. The solution is to deal with the money we've already borrowed, to pay back our debts or default on them. And the creditors are going to have to take their losses, but learn from their mistakes and not lend as much money in the future to contract credit and force Americans to live within their means, which is exactly what would be happening, which would be beneficial, which would help our economy. We could rebuild our savings base, and we could have a way of financing a new industrial revolution in the United States. All of that would help the economy. It wouldn't be painless, but it would be better than the alternative, which is what the government is showing us, which is going to be a lot of pain. Maybe it'll be a little less painful over the next 3 to 6 months, but, I mean, that's a crazy time horizon because, you know, after that, we're going to be a lot worse off than had we not done it. And, of course, you know, when they're talking about the banks and propping up the banks and not letting the banks fail, you know, now the Geithner, they want to have these stress tests. You know, why is the government doing stress tests on banks? Why can't we let the market do stress tests? We think the government's really going to have valid assumptions on what the economy is going to be, what housing prices are going to be. Of course, they're going to have rosy assumptions like they always make. So the government stress tests are going to be, you know, the Mickey Mouse. They're not going to be real. But I'd rather have the stress test of the market. You know, let the market impose a stress test. And if the bank can't handle the stress, let it fail. Sure, it's going to be painful. People are going to lose money. But more people are going to lose more money if the government props them up. That's the problem. The losses are still there, except when the government gets involved, the losses become bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, the losses get diffused among more people, so certain people will benefit from the fact that the banks don't fail. But society as a whole will suffer because the losses will be greater. They might be spread across more people. But also the problem is that by keeping these banks in business, you know, we reward the people who ran them into the ground, and they're able to continue to extract these enormous salaries and bonuses from these businesses. And in the meantime, by keeping these companies afloat, we divert capital away from other companies that could need that capital that should be growing. That could be profitable without government interference. But maybe these companies can't get capital because so much of the capital is being diverted to the government. And you know, you talk about crowding out. Everybody is getting crowded out right now. You can't get any money unless you're the government. And so the government is the only one that can borrow right now. So the government is doing all the investing. But when the government makes investments, they're not going to be real. There's no profit motive. Nobody's investing their own money. No one's got any skin in the game. There's no risks there. You get politicians just trying to get elected, trying to do what's popular. And there's no way that, you know, making decisions based on popularity and based on vote getting, there's no way that these are going to be economical decisions, that they're going to be, you know, what the market the decisions that the market would impose or select. And if we're going to say, well, you know, we were wrong all these years to trust the market to set prices and to allocate resources, that we're much better off letting the government perform these functions. Then we're basically repudiating everything that the founding fathers believed in, everything that Adam Smith wrote about. And we're basically saying that we had it wrong all these years, and the Soviets had it right. You know, the communist Chinese had it right. Fidel Castro had it right. The only problem is that they just didn't implement it correctly, right? They had the right idea to have the government do all this stuff. They just didn't do it right. They had the wrong people. And so now Obama thinks, well, we could do it right. We can implement this strategy, but we can succeed where everybody else failed because we care more and we're smarter. But, you know, this is all nonsense. This is the arrogance of the elitists who are running the country. Unfortunately, the previous administration, they set this up. They don't have anything to stand on now. It's interesting. I did a CNBC today. I was on Kudlow Reports, and it was the first time I was on the air with Art Laffer since the famous Bet You a Penny thing that was on that Peter Schiff video. And, of course, I listened to Art Laffer talk. You know, I was waiting to go on, and he spoke at length. And I agreed with the guy 100%. I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself. Every single criticism he had of the Obama administration and the Federal Reserve was right on the mark. I couldn't have said it better myself. He was 100% correct in everything he said. Now, where was Art Laffer when Bush was president? You know, where was that guy? You know, because he knows his stuff. But where was he then? Unfortunately, he let party loyalty cloud his judgment. Because Bush was in power, he didn't want to talk about the problems in the Bush economy. And so I think he shrugged them off. I don't know if it was a subconscious thing or a conscious thing, but obviously the guy knows inflation and he understands many of these problems because he's articulating them as good as anybody on television right now. But the problem is guys like Art Laffer were not criticizing the economy during the Bush years. And so now nobody really can pay attention, because if they were saying how great everything was in 2004 and 5 and 6 and 7, where's their credibility now? And the fact is they weren't harshly critical of the bailouts and the stimuluses in the Bush administration. So now what's the difference now when Obama does the same thing? Now, the degree is bigger, right? They can say, well, you know, Obama's doing it even worse. His stimulus are even bigger. But once you signed on to the concept, once you said that this stimulus is okay, then you really don't have a solid leg to stand on to now criticizing Obama for doing what you supported in a prior administration. It's too bad more people like Art Laffer, who know better, weren't out there saying the things I was saying when it could have made a difference, and they would have more credibility than they do now. But unfortunately, we really handed this issue, or the Republicans did anyway, or the conservatives handed this issue to the Democrats, and they own it now. And they can continue to blame the problems on the economy, right or wrong, on capitalism, on, you know, it's interesting how, you know, all the different things that Bush did, and there are a lot of things that he did wrong, but what is Obama pinpointing as the thing he did wrong? Cut taxes on the rich. As if, you know, those tax cuts are the reason that we're in so much trouble, right? That and that's what he picks on. We cut taxes on the rich, and this is the mess that we have, you know, which is all a bunch of nonsense. Now, I agree, we should not have simply cut taxes and not spending. In fact, when the Bush tax cuts went into effect, it was as a stimulus. It was early in his first term. They cut taxes, and they also increased government spending. So they intentionally ramped up the deficit to stimulate the economy in the recession that began in Bush's first term. That's the shallow recession that should have been a lot worse. And because it wasn't worse, but because of that stimulus, and mainly not because of the fiscal stimulus, but mainly because of the monetary stimulus, which was far greater, which was Alan Greenspan slashing rates to 1%, leaving them there, and then raising them by quarter point increments for a couple of years. That's why we had the housing bubble, and that's why we're suffering dramatically now, was because of all that stimulus. But the tax cuts, I mean, that's not why were in trouble. I mean, had the government not cut taxes, had they just increased spending more, we would still be in this mess. You know, in fact, the fact that they were able to reduce the tax on dividends, that was a very good thing, reducing the dividend tax to 15%. That was a positive thing. They should have eliminated it to zero. You know, they reduced the capital gains tax. That was a good thing, but they should have eliminated it to zero. But they should have cut government spending, not increased it. They should have reduced the deficit. If they had cut taxes and cut spending, we would have been in much better shape. And had the Federal Reserve not slashed interest rates to the extent that they did, then we would be in phenomenally better shape. But, I mean, that's not even – they're not criticizing that. Barack Obama is not criticizing Alan Greenspan and saying he kept rates too low. How can you criticize Greenspan? Because Bernanke has got them even lower. So if Greenspan made a mistake in bringing rates to 1%, well, what's Bernanke doing? I'm bringing them to zero. So all he can say is that Bush, they shouldn't have cut taxes on the rich. So their only thing that they want to do different from Bush is raise taxes on the rich. They want to repeat every other mistake of the Bush administration, but they want to add tax hikes. Now, obviously, that's just going to make the situation worse, because if you're going to raise taxes, the last thing that you want to do is raise marginal rates. I mean, that's the last thing that you want to do. And that's the first thing that Obama wants to do. They want to raise taxes on people who, you know, are higher income, and they want to raise the taxes on their incomes, right? They don't want to raise taxes on the money that they spend. Right? If they go out and buy a yacht with their money, they're not raising that tax. What they're saying is, if you work harder and earn extra money, then we're going to tax you even more. And a lot of people who have a lot of money already, if you put that kind of barrier to their extra work, if you tell people, if you take this extra risk and put in this extra effort, we're going to punish you by taking more of the gains, then people are less likely to want to work and less likely to want to take that risk. And remember, when people take a risk, if you lose money, the government gives you 100% of the loss. Especially now, the way the tax system works. I mean, somebody can have income, you know, let's say a doctor, a high income doctor, and maybe he wants to fund a business on the side. Start a new business. If the business fails, the IRS doesn't even let you write off the business losses on your second business from your income as a doctor. I mean, they separate it all, you know. And so, if you make an investment in starting a new business, or you know, and if it fails, you're responsible for 100% of the losses. If it succeeds, you know, you only get a part of the profit because the government takes the other part. Well, the bigger the government share, the more money the government claims, the more excused the risk-reward ratios against the venture. And, of course, a lot of, people who are in businesses who are looking at expanding and all the risks of expanding and all the risks associated with hiring more people. I mean, I hire people as a company, and, you know, I've got offices in California, and, you know, the labor laws are very, very skewed, against employers in the state of California. There are a lot of risks involved in employing people and expanding businesses or starting businesses. And to the extent that the government reduces your reward, reduces your incentive, well, people will take less risk. People will decide, I don't need to expand. I don't need to make more money. Besides, I'm not going to get to keep that much of what I make, and maybe I should just work less. Maybe I should just enjoy leisure, because leisure is something that the government doesn't tax at all, right? If you decide not to work and just, enjoy greater leisure, the government doesn't tax that. So people who are very successful have already made a lot of money. It's very easy for people to say, you know what, screw it. I don't need it anymore. I'm not going to hire any more people. I don't need to expand my business. Or you know what, maybe I'll just sell my business. Maybe I'll just retire right now because I don't want to take the risks anymore. And the government's taking too much of my profits and they've increased my regulations. So they close the business or they sell out to a bigger company who just lays off all the workers and takes certain assets. So what the government is doing by trying to punish the people who are working hard, who are taking risks, who are producing, who are providing employment opportunities, we're just going to get less of all that. And the reality is probably going to be that the Obama tax the rich tax hikes are going to produce less revenue for the government, not more revenues. But, you know, when they always attack the Republicans for cutting taxes, and they say, look, they cut taxes and we ran up the deficit, the reason that the deficit was run up was not because of the tax cuts. It was because of the spending. Spending increased, you know, and it's the spending that's causing the deficits, not the tax cuts. In fact, taxes are still too high. Taxes should be a lot lower. But unfortunately, spending is even higher. Spending needs to be much, much lower. But we're not in trouble because the government didn't tax people enough. We're in trouble because the government taxed people too much. But also the government spent too much and regulated too much and interfered too much. And the Federal Reserve printed too much. You know, the government made one mistake after another. And now Barack Obama has come to town thinking that he's going to fix all the mistakes that the government made in the past. But he's just going to make even bigger mistakes. I mean, that's all he's going to do. But I don't know how long it's going to take for people to figure this out. Obviously, as the economy continues to worsen, I think the president's popularity will begin to fade. But unfortunately, he's pretty popular now, which means there's not going to be a lot of opposition to what he wants to do. So he's going to be able to do a lot of damage, you know, in this first you know, year or whatever, however long this honeymoon ends up lasting. Anyway, I know we've got some of the calls starting to queue up, so let me go to the boards. The guy that's on hold the longest, I think, is Jeff in California. Jeff, are you there? All right, let me skip Jeff. He doesn't seem to be answering. What about David in North Carolina?
Okay, I'm here.
Hey, David, you're on the air.
Peter, it's really a pleasure to talk with you, and I just wanted to tell you that I've read your books and got interested in watching you on CNN or CNBC, and I have a number of questions, but really one comment I'd like to make, and that is I know that you talk in your book about the subsequent collapse or the devaluation of the dollar, and I've read Amity Shea's book about Roosevelt's actions in the Great Depression, where that was one thing he purposefully did, and that is obviously a strong argument for buying foreign stocks if the dollar is going to be purposefully devaluated. How does that process occur? I mean, I know that at some point with printing so much.
When Roosevelt devalued the dollar actually had value. When Roosevelt confiscated gold, the dollar, it was 20 ounces of gold. $20 equaled 1 ounce of gold. The dollar actually officially had a value.
Yeah.
And Roosevelt devalued the dollar to the point where you needed $35 to buy an ounce of gold. So that was a significant devaluation. Today the dollar has no value at all. Right, so the dollar isn't necessarily going to be devalued because it has no value, but it has a market value. It doesn't have an official value against gold, but it has value in that you can buy stuff with it. But so what's going to happen to the dollar is not that it will be devalued, but that it will depreciate. Its buying power will depreciate. And now, obviously, in the last the dollar's buying power has actually appreciated. You can buy a lot more with dollars today. You can buy more foreign currencies. Now, you can't buy more gold, so it's certainly lost value relative to the gold, but you can buy more houses with dollars. You can buy more, you know, jewelry. You can buy more cars. I mean, the dollar has gained value, but I don't expect that to last. I think the end game for the dollar is going to be a plunge in value, and I think that the people who are holding on to dollars now as a safe haven, as a store of value, because it seems to be working. There's comfort. A lot of people take comfort in holding dollars because every day they still have their dollars and they're watching their friends who have stocks or have other assets. You know, these assets are going down measured against those dollars. But I think it's a false confidence, and I think at some point the bottom is going to drop out of the dollar. I just don't know when it is. I mean, the dollar has been very resilient. It was strong again today. It didn't make a new high. And, you know, so the dollar index is kind of going sideways, but it's hanging out at the high end of its range. But I do expect the bottom to drop out of it at some point. And then I think once it happens, I think there's going to be a run on the dollar. I think there's nothing else that could possibly happen to the dollar. I just don't see any way out of this without a substantial decline in the dollar.
So when you speak about devaluation of the dollar, Is that relative to gold or relative
to
foreign
currency? Well, again, it's not devaluation. It's depreciation, because the dollar has no official value. It's only worth whatever you can get for it.
Depreciation of the dollar.
I think it's going to depreciate. I think the dollar is going to depreciate relative to other currencies, but I think it will depreciate relative to gold even more, and that has been happening. And ultimately, I think the dollar is even going to depreciate relative to U.S. stocks, relative to U.S. real estate, which means at some point you're going to start to see real estate prices and stock prices in the U.S. rising again. But they will only be rising as a function of the dollar losing value. And I think that I still think that U.S. stocks and real estate will lose value against many foreign currencies and certainly against precious metals like gold and silver.
Well, I appreciate it. I just want to let you know I'm a client, and I just have enjoyed reading your books and listening to your webcast.
Okay, great. Thanks for the positive feedback.
Thank you.
Let me take Julius in North Carolina.
Hey, Peter. How's it going?
Well, how are you?
All right. Thanks. I had a question about sort of a history topic. Most of the people who are contrarians to the Austrian school or more generally laissez-faire economic policies, they cite the panic of 1873 as a long depression. Oftentimes. I've actually heard one particular person mention this on the radio. And they mentioned that, you know, there was a six-year span where, you know, it was just this very bad depression. And, you know, this is before the inception of the Federal Reserve and everything. Can you expand on that and why you think that it wasn't, you know, it may not really have been a problem with laissez-faire economics?
What wasn't a problem with laissez-faire? I mean, the Great Depression?
Well, yeah, not the Great Depression, the one that preceded it, the Long Depression in 1873. Why it behaved differently than the Great Depression?
Made the Great Depression great was what the government did to combat it. I mean, we certainly had severe economic downturns, and you know, and in the past, that there were panics. You know, there was always situations where credit contracted, you know, expanded and contracted. Money supplies grew based on the availability of silver or gold at any particular time, or you know, there were various financial panics that happened, you know, routinely in the United States prior to the Great Depression.
But none of these. I'm familiar with the bank panic that immediately preceded the Federal Reserve inception, but I'm referring more to like the six-year-long depression.
I'm not familiar with the six. I know that there were many, you know, panics, and I forget the exact years where you know there were sharp declines, but they were not long lasting in their duration. In that, ultimately, the free market righted itself, and we moved forward. But one of the arguments in favor of the Federal Reserve was to try to eliminate those types of declines, that we thought that the Fed would be able to, you know, micromanage money supply in such a way that we would mitigate those kind of panics, or, you know, and that was, you know, part of what they wanted to do away with. But of course, the biggest depression that we had happened with the Federal Reserve and with the New Deal, you know, and it was much worse than the downturns that took place that they were hoping to prevent with these actions, you know, with the Fed. And obviously what Roosevelt or Hoover didn't want is he didn't want the downturn in 1929, 1930 to be as bad as some of the ones that happened in the past. So he intervened in ways that he thought was going to make the situation better. And of course he ended up making it much, much worse. And then when Roosevelt came in, he simply, you know, repeated all the mistakes, only on grander scale, and the depression turned into the Great Depression. And you know, we're in danger of doing the same thing now. You know, the main difference now is I think the underlying economic fundamentals are much worse in the United States going into this decline than going into the depression in 1930. And so I think, and the government is in a position, you know, without the gold standard, I think they're in a position to do much more harm this time around than they did back then. So I think we're really on a dangerous, dangerous precipice. And the scariest part is the people in office think that they know, they think that they learned so much from the Depression. They think they know exactly what they have to do to prevent it from happening, and they couldn't be more wrong. You know, they're like the guys, like a sci-fi movie where, you know, there's something happened in the past and they want to go back in time and change history so that this bad thing doesn't happen. And what happens is they go back in history and what they do is what makes the bad thing happen. And it turns out that they're going back in time is why this disaster happened. I think it's very similar. You know, these guys think they know why there's a Great Depression. And so they're going to do something to make sure that it doesn't happen. And in fact, their actions are going to ensure that it does. In fact, they're going to ensure that we get something worse.
Mm-hmm. Other question actually is more along the lines of something in the here and now, but I'm not sure if you've read in any of the blogs or news articles about UBS being sort of requested by the U.S. government to hand over names, you know, citizens that are holding accounts in you know, sort of as tax havens or whatnot. And how do you think that this sort of request, and I know that the U.S. government...
Yeah, I remember when the Swiss banks like UBS first came to the U.S. and were buying out U.S. brokerage firms. At the time, I thought that this was a big mistake. I could not understand. They were coming in generally during the end of the dot-com era, you know, and they were paying top dollar for U.S. brokerage firms and setting up business. And I thought back then, A, they were wasting a lot of money, but they were compromising their independence. And now the government, the U.S. government, is strong-arming these Swiss banks with U.S. operations. They're actually threatening UBS officials with criminal penalties and criminal prosecutions if they don't turn over names of their Swiss client, American clients who have Swiss accounts, which actually violates Swiss law. I mean, apparently the Swiss law allows, if there is an official investigation and there's somebody that's actually charged with a tax fraud or tax crime, that under those circumstances, with an official kind of subpoena or something, that they are allowed within Swiss law to honor that subpoena and furnish the government with the information. But what Swiss law bans them from doing is simply turning over all their clients so the government can look them over, which is what the government wants. The government says, look, we don't even know who your clients are. We just want you to give us a list of all 50,000 customers so we can go over all these accounts and make sure that people are not paying their taxes. Well, that's a violation of Swiss law. It's a violation of bank privacy. But the U.S. government doesn't even care about Swiss law. They're saying, look, if you don't break your own law in your own country, we're going to put you in jail. And, you know, I think ultimately this is going to undermine the U.S. It's going to make companies think twice about opening up offices here or doing business here if the U.S. government is going to basically, you know, act like a bully and try to get around, you know, laws, try to make you violate laws in your own countries by threatening you with imprisonment, even though we have treaties with these countries which require us to respect their laws. So I think, you know, more firms are going to think twice about moving over here, and I also think it undermines UBS's ability to compete as a Swiss bank, because now people are going to say, well, if I'm going to deal with a Swiss bank and I want privacy, asset privacy, I'm not going to deal with any banks that have offices in the United States, because the minute you open up an office in the United States, then you sacrifice all that independence. So it's going to put companies that do business in the United States at a competitive disadvantage with companies that stay out of the United States. And so I don't think there's any way this is going to be good for us. Ultimately, it might mean the U.S. government is going to be able to get some extra tax revenues out of some of these 50,000 people, but ultimately, I don't think that's going to be a good thing for our country, because they're just going to take that money and waste it along with the rest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted to hear your take about how Swiss banks would sort of...
But, you know, I think the whole thing is ridiculous, because we shouldn't even have an income tax. And if we didn't have an income tax, people wouldn't be, you know, sheltering their money offshore to try to, you know, minimize, you know, evade the tax. I mean, we shouldn't even have a tax like this. And, of course, I think other reasons that people have money offshore have nothing to do with taxes and other types of privacy. I mean, there's so much frivolous litigation going on in this country. A lot of people want to try to protect their assets from the courts. And so people have money offshore for a number of reasons. But, you know, the fact of the matter is the U.S. government should not be collecting taxes through income. I mean, it's just not to raise taxes. I don't think it's not a constitutional way to raise taxes. And, you know, the U.S. is very unique. Most countries in the world, if you have income outside the United States, the country that you live in does not tax it. There's only a few countries in the world that tax your global income.
Yeah,
America is one of them.
It was just a couple, actually, like Libya or United States.
And here's the crazy thing. You know, it's like, you know, do you know what the biggest tax haven is in the world? It's America. It's the United States. Because most countries, you know, if you're a German and you put your money in France, what happens is, if you know, Germany doesn't tax the income, but France does. You know, France says, okay, you're a German citizen, you put your money in France, we're going to tax you. But Germany doesn't tax you because you're making the money in France.
Mm-hmm.
Well, America, the way America treats foreigners, America says, if you're a German and you put your money in America, America won't tax you. So America is basically the world's biggest tax haven for people that live outside of America. So if you're a foreigner and you're living in the country, you can move your money to America to avoid taxes. But America makes it very difficult for its own citizens to do the same thing because America, U.S. government says, we don't care where your money is. You put your money in any other country or you earn money in another country, you're paying taxes to us. And so that we tax you for the privilege of being an American. And we're saying, you know, because even if you're an American and you leave the country, if you physically move out of the country and take up permanent residence in another country and never even set foot in America, the U.S. government still expects you to pay income taxes on all that income, even though none of it was derived in America and you weren't even on American soil. The only way that you can get out of the tax is to give up your citizenship. But even then, I think if you give up your citizenship and you earn money, I think, I'm not sure the exact number of years, but I think for 5 or 10 years, they can still tax you.
Wonderful.
And now they've got stuff that says when you give up your citizenship, what I think they do now, based on a new law, is any assets that you own, they immediately assume that you sold them on the day you renounced your citizenship and require you to pay the capital gains taxes, even though you haven't realized the capital gains yet. They force you to say, well, if you've got appreciated assets and you give up your citizenship, then you're going to pay the tax based on how much those assets had appreciated. So, I mean, the governor's making it harder and harder to give up citizenship without incurring massive tax penalties, which is obviously a bad sign. When more and more Americans are trying to renounce their citizenship and move abroad, you got to figure that you're doing something wrong when you're chasing your citizens out of the country.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for taking my call, Peter.
Thanks for calling. Next up is Mark in California.
Hello,
Mark,
Peter.
You're on the air.
Hi there. Hey, Peter, I'm a client, and I've read both your books. Hey, I'm one of the few people that downloaded your archives starting from 2006 and 7 and into 2008 and 9, and I just want to say, anybody who hasn't done that, it's a really interesting history lesson.
You're talking about the video archives or the
I'm talking about the audio archives. It was really kind of comical because in 06, in some of your first shows, you were sitting there and you weren't even sure that you were on the air because you weren't getting any calls coming in. Now you're a regular on TV. It's kind of a...
Well, I think I started long before. I think I started in 04, didn't I, with a radio show?
Yeah, you might have done. I started in 06 because I just didn't want to download that. But even in 06, it was funny because you didn't have any calls coming in and you weren't sure if you were on the air. And it was, you know, you come to today where you've come a long way. So you're obviously getting your message out, and congratulations on that.
Thanks.
Hey, the reason I called was I wanted to ask you, in some of your archives, you were talking about the historical relationship between oil and gold. And I think most recently I was listening to a radio archive back in June of 08 where oil was trading somewhere around 130, 140, and gold was around 920. And now we look at today where, you know, oil's teetering around the $40 mark, and gold is, you know, again around 930, I think, today is where it's hovering around. And I wonder if you could comment on the divergence of the price of oil and gold and what that meant then and what that means now and what it could mean in the future and, what you know, how that relationship works and such.
Oh, can you repeat that? I just got distracted on something.
Yeah, no problem. The relationship of the divergence of the price of oil and gold and how it related back when oil was 140 and gold was 920, say in June of 08, and now we look at the snapshot of today where gold's around 40, oil's around 40 and gold's around 930, and the divergence of the price and what that means. And
well, obviously markets fluctuate, and at one point when oil was 140 and gold was 800 or wherever it was, 700, that oil was very expensive relative to gold, as expensive as it's been. Today, oil, I think, is as cheap as it's ever been in terms of gold. In fact, I think it's cheaper. If you go back to before the Arab oil embargo, before we really devalued our dollar in the 1970s, gold was $35 an ounce, and oil was $3 a barrel. $3 a barrel. So if you figure the gold-oil relationship, it was almost 10 to 1, right? Maybe it took, you know, or 1 ounce of gold would buy you 10 barrels of oil, right? Today, right. 1 ounce of gold is about 950, and oil is, what, like $35 a barrel now?
Yeah, it's teetering around the 40. It's about 20, 25.
But you can now buy, what, over 25 barrels of oil for an ounce of gold. This is the cheapest, I think, oil has ever been, maybe like in history.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny, too. That's how you can really see the depreciation, the value of our money. Because in dollars, in paper dollars, right, oil is still 10 times what it was, you know, before we went off the gold standard. The price of oil in paper dollars has risen tenfold. Right. But in terms of gold, real money, the price of oil has fallen by 60-70%. I mean, so when people say that oil prices are higher than they were 30, 40 years ago, they're not. They're much lower. Now, if you pay for them with depreciated money, like U.S. Federal Reserve notes, then it looks like oil's gotten more expensive. But if you look at it in terms of gold, which is the money that we used up until 1971, based on that money, oil prices have collapsed. Now, the fact of the matter is oil is obviously too cheap. You know, and it's not going to stay. I mean, my bet would be that if you were to say, you know, relative to the price of gold, I do expect oil prices to move higher. I mean, I expect that rate relationship of maybe 10 to 1, you know, to get, you know, closer in about 12, whatever it's the historical norm is. I think we will get back there. But also, I think that, you know, gold could maintain a premium to oil, not as great as the one that we have now, but a premium that's larger than normal due to the fact that there is so much inflation being created, so much economic uncertainty, and I think gold is so overowned, and I think there's going to be such a rush into gold that I think that gold could end up being, you know, expensive relative to oil for a while. But I don't think it'll be as expensive as it is right now.
I think that reflects the oil. If you look at the movement of the oil from the high of 147 a barrel to today's prices, and you lay up the dollar index against it, it's definitely, you know, propping up the temporary artificial strength in the dollar is a direct correlation, I think, too.
Yeah, well, that's part of the reason that the prices. Now, you remember too, for people in other countries, like somebody in Australia, the oil price is not down nearly as much as it is in America. You know, we've enjoyed a much bigger decrease in oil prices than a lot of other countries because other countries have had weaker currencies. And so the oil price is not down as much. If the dollar had not weakened, oil prices would be substantially higher. Because what's happening in other countries where their currencies are weakening, they're using less oil because oil prices are rising for them or they're still high relative to where their economies are. So the fact is other people are cutting back on oil consumption more than we are because they're seeing bigger, you know, they're not seeing as big a price cut.
Right, they're hurt by it more. I did have one
but
more question for you.
That's going to turn around, and it's been my theory that once especially these Asian currencies like China depeg from the dollar and you see substantial appreciation in those currencies, that there will be big increase in consumption of things like oil in countries like China, which will drive prices up for us.
Yeah, I think they have nowhere to go up. I did have one more quick question, and it relates to gold mining stocks. I've been read your books, and I'm looking at the juniors and the mid tier and the Barricks of the world. And I guess my question is it okay to own these in U.S. dollar based stocks?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you trade them in New York, in South Africa, in Canada. They're gold mining stocks, but obviously, what's important to them is, you know, where they're producing gold, and the exchange rates matter. So right now, a lot of these gold stocks that are producing in Australia or Latin America, you know, their production costs have plunged because in terms of those local currencies, gold prices are much higher. So I think gold mining is a very profitable business right now, and at some point, I'm looking for a lot of these companies to start reporting very, very good earnings, and that should be, you know, maybe turn the dynamic for these gold stocks, which have been underperforming gold for some time. Anyway, thanks for the call. I got a hop. We're going about 13 minutes. A bunch of calls left. So let me go to Brian in New York.
Hey,
Brian,
Peter?
You there?
Hey, Peter.
Yes.
How's it going? I have a couple of questions.
Okay, let's make them quick. Let's take no more calls because I got three people on hold, and I've only got about 13 minutes. Go ahead, Brian.
All right, I'll make it quick for you. I know you're big into productivity. It's what makes an economy grow. I was just wondering what you thought of the fact that from 1940 to 1980, the top marginal tax rate was about 70 to 90%. How do you respond to that, considering that was probably the most productive time period for the United States?
Well, I don't think it was the most productive time period. I think the most productive time period was during the Industrial Revolution, probably from, you know, after the Civil War, 1870s, 1880s through 1910-ish was the most productive time period. But during the time where we had really, really high marginal tax rates, the reality is very few Americans actually paid those very high rates because they applied to incomes that were really in the stratosphere. In fact, back in that period of time, average Americans, middle-class Americans, paid zero income taxes. I mean, they didn't pay any at all. Was there were so many deductions, there were so many ways to shelter your income that even though the tax rates were that high, nobody paid him because everything was deductible, and people had ways to arrange their affairs so that they didn't pay those 80 and 90% taxes. And so it was, it created some distortions in the economy, and it wasn't as efficient as things otherwise could have been. But people were able to easily get around those high tax rates. The problem is now the tax rates are not as high, but people are paying much more in taxes because you don't have the deductions and you don't have the loopholes. And of course, the tax rates now apply to everybody. I mean, I think, back then, even those high tax rates, when they applied, people were making, 100 times what the average income made. I mean, if you just made 5 or 10 times the average income, you still didn't pay any income taxes. And the tax was really on the upper, maybe it was the top 1% of the country paid the tax. When the tax really started to get paid by the average American, it was in the Second World War. It was in 1942 we had passed the Victory Tax, and that's when we introduced withholding, and we really brought the average American into the income tax. And unfortunately, when the Second World War ended, and the government no longer needed all that money because we demobilized, 10 million men, instead of abolishing the withholding tax and returning the money to people, the government just simply invented new ways to spend the money, and the government kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Right, okay. Do you still disagree with the ideology that, the incentive there is to keep the money in the company and not take it out of the company? That's the intention, at least. Do you still disagree with that idea? I mean, you know, Lloyd Blankfein making in 2007, he made something like, $70 million.
Well, I disagree with the whole compensation structure that exists on Wall Street, but those were private decisions that were made by shareholders and boards of directors. Unfortunately, they've now been turned into public decisions because the massive losses that these ridiculous compensation packages ended up causing is now being put on the backs of every American citizen. That's the wrong part. It's the people who bought stocks in these companies, who loaned money to these companies, that should be suffering the consequences of their own bad decisions and their own decisions to pay people based on short-term performance, regardless of what that performance did to the ultimate long-term results of the company. Because most of the people earn bonuses doing things that are responsible for their bankruptcies.
Right.
But anyway, thanks for the call. Oh, I want to mention one thing real interesting, too. When they first passed the income tax, I think there was a movement and people wanted to put a cap on the income tax, and I think they wanted to cap it. I can't remember what it was, 5%, 7%, 8%, maybe it was as high as 10%, but they wanted to actually write into the 16th Amendment a cap that said that you can tax income, but it can't be any higher than this. Now, I wish they'd have put that cap in there, but the reason they didn't put the cap is because people were afraid that if they put a cap of 10%, that one day they might actually raise the tax as high as 10%. So, because the original tax, I think, was 2%. It was very low. And so they didn't want to put a cap because they were afraid that by putting a cap, that one day Congress might actually raise it to the cap. But anyway, and now you see what we're dealing with. Anyway, let me go to Gary in Michigan. Go ahead, Gary. Is Gary there?
Yes. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
I had a couple questions.
Just ask one. I don't have a lot of time.
Okay. Gold set to go on a bull run as far as the general consensus. How do you determine or see any signs when it's turning into a bubble?
Well, you know, I mentioned that on my podcast or on my video blog the other day. In fact, if you go and Google an article I wrote 2.5 years ago back in early 06, if you type Peter Schiff, 10 Signs of a Precious Metals Bubble, you can write an article I wrote. It's kind of funny. It's a takeoff on the David Letterman, top 10. But people were talking about a bubble back then, and gold was around 500. And I remember thinking, look, it's not a bubble. I still don't think it's a bubble. Doesn't mean the price can't go down. I think it's got a long way to go before it has bubble characteristics. The average person isn't buying. In fact, one of the things people talk about as showing a bubble is all these ads for, cash for gold, cash for gold. But that's the opposite of the sign of a bubble. That's people selling their gold. That's companies encouraging Americans to take their old gold jewelry and get rid of it for cash. So really, at the end of a bull market, people aren't going to be looking to get rid of their gold. They're going to be buying gold. And I still think that most Americans don't own gold. Most Americans don't even know anybody who owns gold. But certainly gold is getting more popular than it was, and more people are advocating it now, so that maybe that means there's going to be a correction. But, look, I think gold is going a lot higher. And if you look at some of the bullish calls coming out of the major brokerage firms, people are saying gold, 1,000, gold, 1,200. I mean, these are not crazy calls. I think by the time you see the end of the gold bull market, maybe gold will be $5,000 an ounce, and someone's going to come out and say it's going to $20,000. You're going to have outrageous calls. Like when oil did top out around 140, people were predicting 300. So, people were coming out there with really big, big calls. Right now, nobody is making a way over the top call on how much they think gold is going to rise. Everybody is kind of being cautious in their predictions for gold prices, and no one is predicting too big a run. So I think that's a good sign. Anyway, thanks for the call. I want to get through these last two calls. Bill from Florida. Go ahead, Bill.
Hi, Peter. I have a question. I'm wondering what you think would be a good country to go to if you wish to expatriate and work someplace else?
I don't know. I mean, it all depends on individual tastes and lifestyles and climates that you like and cultures and languages you might speak and people that you might know. But unfortunately, and I mentioned this in the little book, and I think things have the potential to get very, very bad here. And if the government continues on these lines, it's going to get more and more oppressive because, as I said, I think price controls are coming. I think capital controls are coming. I think as the government interferes with the economy and further undermines its effectiveness and productivity, it's going to make the climate worse. People are going to then be looking to black markets or evading rules, and the government's going to have to get more and more oppressive to force us to do what it wants us to do when we want to do something else, because what it wants us to do is detrimental to our financial lives and our own lives. So, look, I think there are a lot of problems on the horizon. I think more crime is coming. And so, for some people, leaving the country, may be the best thing to do. I haven't taken that route personally. I hope I don't regret it, but I'm still here sticking it out. But I certainly wouldn't fault anybody for leaving.
Well, do you have any ideas of which countries you,
unfortunately, everybody seems to speak English everywhere I go, but, I like the English-speaking countries because, that's really the only language that I'm fluent in, so. But, there are other countries that are closer to the U.S. and, south of the border, down in Latin America, there's some places people can go, even up north in Canada. Canada's pretty close. Places that people can go. It's all different. I haven't really thoroughly researched it to try to determine ideally, what's the best place to expatriate to. Because it's going to be different for different people and where you know people.
Well, strictly from an economic sense.
Well, look, from an economic sense, I think the freest countries are all in Asia. Some of the, I think there's the most opportunity for young entrepreneurs to start businesses and to grow, which is why I've been saying that one of the best things that your kids can do is learn Mandarin. That's going to be the new frontier. I think there's going to be tremendous wealth created and a lot, the next Henry Fords and Vanderbilts these guys are going to come out of China. And, there's going to be tremendous wealth created and fortunes made over there. And, people might want to get in on it. Anyway, thanks for the call. Last one online, I think is Bill in Florida. I think someone just. Is it Don? No, Don in Pennsylvania.
Peter, I loved the book that I read that you had wrote a year and a half ago where you predicted a plunge in the U.S. dollar, a decoupling of the U.S. economy from the foreign economy. Now, since the exact opposite of what you predicted has in fact happened, have you ever considered the prospect of refunding the large commission you've charged to your customers for taking your advice now that they've lost half their money with you?
We don't have a lot of time to answer your question, but I would say if you reread my book, this is not the exact opposite of what I predicted. In fact, I actually predicted in my book that when the U.S. markets went down, that foreign markets would go down too, and that the stocks that I recommended in the chapter on stocks would go down. I didn't say that decoupling was going to happen instantaneously. I said that it would take time. I said that the initial reaction to our problems around the rest of the world was going to create some buying opportunities in the rest of the world because they were going to misjudge what was happening. They were going to see the problems in the United States, and they were going to assume that because we're too broke to consume, that somehow that was going to destroy their economies. That is wrong. But I think governments around the world are taking actions that are misguided. They think they have to prop up the United States when they don't, and they're hurting their own economies in the process, and they're also long-term hurting the U.S. economy. But ultimately, I think everything is going to play out the way I said it was. I think the only thing that happened that I did not expect to happen was the sharp rally in the value of the U.S. dollar. I didn't see that coming, although the dollar lost a lot of value. When I first wrote Crash Proof, the dollar index was at 86, and it fell to 70 after the book came out. Now, it had a sharp rally back up. Right now, it's about 87, so it had a big rally ever since the crisis began to emerge, but the crisis started exactly the way I said it would start, and we're a long way from over. You know, this thing has just begun, and I think by the time the collapse fully plays out, I think all the predictions that I made in Crash Proof, which were all long-term predictions, none of them were short-term oriented, but I think they're all going to pan out. So the jury is still out. You know, in 3 to 5 years, if you want to call the show again, and if these things haven't happened, then maybe you'll have a point, but it's too early to say anything now. Anyway, if you want to call again earlier in the show, there's not a lot of time for this because I'm running out of time. Anyway, thanks for calling. Anyway, again, the book is Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse. I still think it's valid. I am revising that book with the issues of things that maybe are different from how I said they would be. I'm working on Crash Proof 2.0 right now. In the meantime, I address some of the issues in my later book, The Little Book of Bull Moves in Bear Markets. Anyway, that's it for today. Don't forget, again, visit the website, www.europac.net. Look for the special report coming out on the five favorite stocks for the next 5 years. You should have the most recent issue of the newsletter, The Global Investor. And also, again, don't forget to sign up for the new Peter Schiff video blog. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. Bye-bye.